but further statement from Council Ruff.
The chair recognizes Mr. Council Ruff to continue his presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. My first question is it working? Thank you very much. I apologize for the mechanical difficulties earlier. I could go back over the first hour, but I'll move on. I want now to move to an overview of the articles of impeachment themselves. As I said, as I came to the end of the first hour, these articles are constitutionally defective. They are also unsupported by the evidence. As we have noted, both articles are framed in the broadest generalities and composed of multiple different offenses. Nothing contained in the Judiciary Committee's majority report, or in the trial brief, or in the presentation of the managers can cure the constitutional infirmity that infects these articles. Nonetheless, in framing our defense, they provide the only way through this uncharted landscape. We have divided our substantive response to the articles into three parts. Tomorrow, Mr. Craig will address the charges in Article 1 that the President committed perjury before the grand jury. Second, Ms. Mills will address those parts of Article 2 that charge the President with obstructing justice by causing the concealment of gifts he had given to Ms. Lewinsky, and that he engaged in witness tampering in his conversations with Ms. Curry. And third, Mr. Kendall will address the remaining allegations of obstruction, which will be on Thursday, and then we will close by hearing from Senator Bumpers. Before I move to an overview of the articles and response you'll hear over the next couple of days, I want to suggest to you an approach to one of the most difficult questions that you face. How does one sitting in judgment on a case like this assess the reliability of what he or she hears and sees? Let me offer one test. Those of you who have practiced on one side or the other in the criminal justice system know that that system places a special responsibility on prosecutors, a burden to be open and candid and forthcoming in argument and, most importantly, in representing the facts, so that when a prosecutor recites the facts, he's not expected to ignore the unfavorable ones. He's expected to be open with judge and jury. Of course, he can make an argument as to why a particular fact is really not so important, but he can neither conceal it nor misrepresent it. And so when you hear a prosecutor or a team of prosecutors misstate a fact or not tell you the whole story, you should wonder why. You should ask yourself whether the misstatement was an inadvertent error or whether it signals some underlying flaw in the prosecution's case, some problem that they're trying to conceal. And one ought to be particularly skeptical when the fact that is concealed or isn't fully revealed is claimed by the prosecutors themselves to be crucial to their case. Now, we all sometimes speak with less than complete care, and we are justly criticized when we make mistakes. If I tell you something inadvertently that proves to be wrong, I expect to be held to account for that. And similarly, we must hold the managers accountable for their mistakes. Last week, for example, you will recall that Mr. Manager Sensenbrenner told you that during my appearance before the Judiciary Committee, in his words, Charles Ruff was asked directly, did the President lie during his sworn grand jury testimony? And Mr. Ruff could have answered that question directly. He did not, and his failure to do so speaks a thousand words. Now, just to be certain that the record is straight, let me read to you from the transcript of that Judiciary Committee hearing.
Representative Sensenbrenner.
The oath that witnesses take require them to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And I seem to recall that there were a lot of people, myself included, when asked by the press what advice we would give to the president when he went into the grand jury in August, was to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Mr. Ruff, indeed. Representative Sensenbrenner, did he tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth when he was in the grand jury? Mr. Ruff, he surely did. I'm certain that Mr. Sensenbrenner would not intentionally mislead the Senate, that his error was one of inadvertence, but in any event, now the record is clear. Of considerably more importance than this momentary lapse are the many substantive flaws that we will point out to you in the coming days, sometimes pure errors of fact, sometimes errors of interpretation, sometimes unfounded speculation. My colleagues will deal with many of these flaws at greater length as they discuss the specific charges against the president, but I'll give you a couple of examples as I reach the appropriate points in my overview today, because I want you to have in mind throughout our presentation, and indeed throughout the rest of these proceedings, this one principle. Be wary of the prosecutor who feels it necessary to deceive the court. And begin with Article 1. Our system of justice recognizes the difficulties inherent in testifying under oath, and it affords important protections for the witness who may be charged with perjury. And thus the Judiciary Committee's dissatisfaction with the president's answers because they thought they were narrow or even hair-splitting, in some sense, reflects a dissatisfaction with the rules that have been applied for centuries in prosecuting this offense. Perjury requires proof that a defendant knowingly made a false statement about a material fact. The defendant must have had a subjective intent to lie. Testimony that's provided as a result of confusion or mistake or faulty memory or carelessness or misunderstanding is not perjury. The mere fact that the recollections of two witnesses may differ does not mean that one is committing perjury. Common sense and the stringent requirements of the law dictate that more is required. As the Supreme Court has noted, quote, equally honest witnesses may well have differing recollections of the same event. And thus, quote, a conviction for perjury ought not to rest entirely upon an oath against an oath. This is the rationale for the common practice of prosecutors to require significant corroborating evidence before they bring a perjury case. Indeed, the Department of Justice urges that its prosecutors seek independent corroboration, either two witnesses or corroborating evidence of a quality to assure that a guilty verdict is really well-founded. Now, this isn't merely an argument we make because we are advocates for the president. A bipartisan panel of former federal prosecutors, about whom you will hear more, testified that neither they nor any reasonable prosecutor would charge perjury based upon the facts in this case. Tom Sullivan, former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, told the committee that the evidence set out in the Starr report would not be prosecuted as a criminal case by a responsible federal prosecutor. Richard Davis, former colleague of mine in the Watergate Special Prosecution Force, testified that no prosecutor would bring this case of perjury because the president acknowledged to the grand jury the existence of an improper relationship and argued with prosecutors questioning him that his acknowledged conduct was not a sexual relationship as he understood the definition of that term used in the Jones deposition. And that is where you need to begin your focus as you look at the charge that the president perjured himself in the grand jury in August of last year. Any assessment of that testimony must begin with one immutable fact. He admitted that he had, in his words, inappropriate intimate contact with Monica Lewinsky. No one who was present for that testimony, has read the transcript, or watched the videotape, could come away believing anything other than that the president and Ms. Lewinsky engaged in sexual conduct. Indeed, even the prosecutors, who surely cannot be accused of being reluctant to find presidential misconduct, contended not that the president had lied about the nature of his relationship, but only about the details. Yet the managers, in their eagerness to find misconduct where none had found it before, have searched every nook and cranny of the grand jury transcript and sent forward to you a shopping list of alleged misstatements, obviously in the hope that among them you will find one with which you disagree. But they hope in vain. The record simply will not support a finding that the president perjured himself before the grand jury. Now, much of the questioning by the prosecutors and much of the grand jury testimony about which the House now complains so vociferously dealt with the president's efforts to explain why his answers in the Jones deposition, certainly not pretty, were in his mind truthful, albeit narrowly and artfully constructed. We are not here to talk to you today about the president's testimony in the Jones deposition. We do seek to convince you that before the grand jury, the president was open, candid, truthful. Now, the managers begin by asking you to look at the prepared statement that the president offered at the very beginning of his grand jury appearance. Before the president actually began his testimony, his lawyer, Mr. Kendall, spoke to Mr. Starr and told him that at the first moment at which there was an inquiry concerning the detailed nature of the relationship with Ms. Lewinsky, he wished to make a prepared statement, and he was permitted to do so. That statement acknowledged the existence of an intimate relationship, but it did not discuss the specific physical details in what I think we will all understand to have been an effort to preserve the dignity of the office. Now, the House has charged that this statement was somehow a, quote, premeditated effort to thwart the OIC's investigation. That is arrant nonsense. Even the independent counsel saw no such dark motive in this statement. Now, first, the managers advanced the baseless charge that the president intentionally placed the beginning of his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky in 1996 rather than 1995, as she has testified. Interestingly, they don't even purport to offer any support for this charge other than Ms. Lewinsky's testimony, and they offer not even the somewhat odd explanation originally offered by the independent counsel to explain why the president, having admitted the very worst things a father and a husband can conceive of admitting, would have shifted the time by 3 months. Next, the managers assert that the president's admission that he engaged in wrongful conduct, quote, on certain occasions, unquote, was false because the president actually engaged in such conduct some 11 times. And they assert as well that when the president admitted he had occasional telephone conversations that included inappropriate discussions, that was false because they had actually had 17 such phone conversations. Now, the president gave his best recollection of the frequency of those contacts. Ms. Lewinsky gave hers. Assuming that the majority is correct in its assumption that there were 11 or 17, can anyone imagine a trial in this court or in any other court in which the issue of whether certain occasions by definition could not mean 17 and occasionally could not refer to 11 would be the issue being litigated? Even the independent counsel, again, who could of course have pressed the president for specific numbers had they thought it important, did not take issue with this testimony. So thus the perjury charge in Article 1 again comes down to the same allegations contained in the independent counsel's referral, that the president lied to the grand jury about two things: his subjective, his personal subjective understanding of the definition used in the Jones deposition, and second, he lied when he denied that he engaged in certain details of inappropriate conduct. Now, to conclude that the president lied to the grand jury about his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky, you must determine, forgive me, that he touched certain parts of her body, but for proof you have only her oath against his oath. Those among you who have been prosecutors or criminal defense lawyers know that perjury prosecutions, as rare as they are, would never be pursued on the evidence available here. And those among you who do not bring that special experience, at least bring your common sense and are equally able to assess the weakness of a case that would rest on such a foundation. Common sense also is enough to tell you that there cannot be any basis for charging a witness with perjury on the ground that you disbelieve his testimony about his own subjective belief in a definition of a term used in a civil deposition. Not only is there no evidence to support such a charge here, it is difficult to contemplate what evidence the managers might hope to rely on to meet that burden. Now, it's worth noting that Mr. Bennett, at the time of the deposition, pressed the Jones lawyers to ask the president specific questions about his conduct, rather than rely on this confusing definition that they'd proffered. In fact, when the president was asked in the grand jury whether he would have answered those questions, he said, of course, if the judge had ruled them appropriate, he would have answered truthfully. But the Jones lawyers persisted in their somewhat strange course, strange unless one asked whether, armed with Ms. Tripp's intelligence, they purposely sought in some fashion to present the independent counsel a record that would permit just the sort of dark interpretation both he and the managers have proffered. I point you to one thing if you seek evidence that the president took the definition he was given seriously and he responded carefully to the questions put to him, even if they required the most embarrassing answers. One need only look to the painful admission that he did have relations with another woman, and he testified to the grand jury the definition required that he make that admission. Here's what he said to the grand jurors. I read this carefully, and I thought about it, and I thought about what contact meant, and I thought about other phrases, my interpolation, and I had to admit under this definition that I'd actually had relations with Jennifer Flowers. Now, undeterred in its search for some ground on which to base the charge that the president lied to the grand jury, Article 1 abandons even the modest level of specificity found in the independent counsel's referral and advances the claim, quote, the president gave perjurious, false, and misleading testimony regarding prior statements of the same nature he made in his deposition. There can be no stronger evidence of the constitutional deficiency of this article than this strangely amorphous charge. And it's a deficiency that becomes even more obvious when you finally stumble across the theory on which the managers rely. To the extent one can determine what the Judiciary Committee had in mind when drafted this clause, it appears that they intended to charge the president with perjury before the grand jury because he testified that he believed that he had, in his words, quote, worked through the minefield of the Jones deposition without violating the law, and that they hoped to support that charge by reference to various allegedly false statements in his deposition as charged in Article 2. Unhappily for the managers, however, the House rejected Article 2, and it is not before you in any form. Moreover, there is not a single suggestion in the committee debate, or more importantly, in the House debate, that those voting to impeach the president believe that this one line that I've quoted to you from the president's grand jury testimony somehow absorbed into Article 1 his entire deposition testimony. If there's to be any regard for constitutional process, the managers cannot be allowed to rely on what the Judiciary Committee thought were false statements encompassed in a rejected Article 2 to flesh out the unconstitutionally non-specific charges of Article 1. The House's vote on Article 2 foreclosed that option for all time. Now, Article 1 next alleges that the President lied to the grand jury about the events surrounding certain statements made by Mr. Bennett during the Jones deposition, specifically the manager's charge that the President was silent when Mr. Bennett characterized the Lewinsky affidavit as meaning there is no sex of any kind in any manner, shape, or form with President Clinton, and that the President then gave a false explanation to the grand jury when he testified that he wasn't really paying attention when his lawyer said that. Now, as we noted earlier, Mr. Bennett argued to Judge Wright that in light of Ms. Lewinsky's affidavit denying a relationship, the Jones lawyers had no good faith basis for questioning the President about her. The President was not involved in the lengthy back and forth among the judge, the Jones lawyers, and Mr. Bennett. He said nothing. When he was asked in the grand jury about Mr. Bennett's statement, he said, "I'm not even sure I paid much attention to what Mr. Bennett was saying." Now, the managers assert that this is false because the videotape shows that the President was in fact paying attention. But a fair review of the videotape, I suggest to you, shows a President looking indeed in Mr. Bennett's direction and in the direction of the judge, but giving no sign that he was following the discussion. He did nod his head, he didn't make facial expressions, he did nothing to reflect the awareness of the substance of what was happening, much less what was said in Mr. Bennett's statement. Now, I don't know how large a group this would be, but any of you who's ever represented a witness or been a witness in a deposition will readily understand the President's mindset as the lawyers and the judge debated these issues. And you will understand, too, that to charge him with perjury for having testified falsely about his own state of mind with nothing more to rely on than a picture would strain credulity in any prosecutor's office and flies past the bounds of constitutional reason in this chamber. I move now to the allegations in Article 2, charging the President with obstruction of justice in the Jones lawsuit and in the grand jury investigation. I want to talk first about what's become known as the concealment of gifts theory. The allegation that the President participated in some scheme to conceal certain gifts he had given to Ms. Lewinsky centers on two events allegedly occurring on December 28, 1997. First, a conversation between the President and Ms. Lewinsky in the White House in which the two discussed the gifts, at least briefly, that he had given to Ms. Lewinsky. And B, Ms. Curry's picking up a box of gifts from Ms. Lewinsky and storing them under her bed. The managers, as was true of the majority report and the independent counsel rule before them, build their theory in this case not on any pillars of obstruction, but on shifting sandcastles of speculation. Monica Lewinsky met with the President on December 28, 1997, sometime shortly before 8 a.m., to exchange Christmas presents. According to Ms. Lewinsky, they briefly discussed the subject of gifts she had received from the President in connection with her receipt some days earlier of a subpoena in the Jones case. And this was the first and the only time, she says, in which the subject was ever discussed. And the managers quote one version of Ms. Lewinsky's description of that December 28th conversation as follows. "At some point I said to him, well, you know, should I? Maybe I should put the gifts away outside my house somewhere or give them to someone, maybe Betty. And he sort of said, I think he responded, I don't know, or let me think about that, and left that topic. But the Senate should know that, in fact, Ms. Lewinsky has discussed this very exchange on at least 10 different occasions, and that the very most she alleges in any of them is that the President said, I don't know, or let me think about it, when she raised the issue of the gifts. Indeed, in many of her versions, she said, among other things, there really was no response, that the President did not respond, that she didn't have a clear image in her mind what to do next. She also testified that Ms. Curry's name did not come up because the president really didn't say anything. And most importantly, in not a single one of her multiple versions of this event, did she say that the president ever initiated any discussion about the gifts, nor did he ever suggest to her that she concealed them. Now, there being no evidence of obstruction in that conversation, the managers would have you believe that after Ms. Lewinsky left the White House that day, the president must have told Betty Curry to retrieve the gifts from Ms. Lewinsky. But there's absolutely no evidence that that discussion ever occurred. The only two parties who would have knowledge of it, the president and Ms. Curry, both denied it ever took place. Now, in the absence of any such evidence, the managers have relied on Ms. Lewinsky's testimony that Ms. Curry placed a call to her and told her, depending on Ms. Lewinsky's version, either that the president had said to Betty, Ms. Lewinsky had something for her, or merely that she, Ms. Curry, understood that Ms. Lewinsky had something for her. In this regard, it's important to remember that Ms. Lewinsky herself testified that she was the one who first raised with the president the notion that Ms. Curry could hold the gifts. And it's important to recognize that, contrary to the manager's suggestion to you, that Ms. Lewinsky's memory of this event has always been consistent and unequivocal, I think was their word. She herself acknowledged at her last grand jury appearance that her memory of the crucial conversation is less than crystal clear. To wit, a juror, do you remember Betty Curry saying that the president had told her to call? Ms. Lewinsky, right now, I don't remember. And now we come to the first example I promised you of prosecutorial, what shall we call it, fudge. Starting from the premise that Betty Curry called Monica Lewinsky and told her that she understood she had something for her, and then went to pick up a sealed box containing some of the gifts she had received, Ms. Lewinsky had received from the president. First, the independent counsel concluded, and then the majority report concluded, and now the managers have concluded that the president must have instructed Ms. Curry to go pick up these gifts, to call Ms. Lewinsky and make the arrangements. So that they determined that when Ms. Curry said it was Ms. Lewinsky who called her, Ms. Curry was mistaken, or, if you listen carefully, maybe worse. And when the president testified that he didn't tell Ms. Curry to call Ms. Lewinsky, he was, well, just worse. And this surmise is made absolutely certain in the view of the managers because a newly discovered, unknown even to the independent counsel, cell phone record shows that Ms. Curry called Ms. Lewinsky at 3:32 p.m. on December 28th. And that must be the call that Ms. Lewinsky remembered. Let's look now at how the majority counsel for the committee put it in his closing argument to the Judiciary Committee. And I put his words up on the chart, and you all should have it in front of you as well. There is key evidence, said majority counsel, that Ms. Curry's fuzzy recollection is wrong. Monica said that she thought Betty called her from cell phone. Well, look at this record. I'll show it to you in a moment. This is Betty's cell phone record. It corroborates Monica Lewinsky and proves conclusively that Ms. Curry called Monica from her cell phone several hours after she had left the White House. Why did Betty Curry pick up the gifts from Ms. Lewinsky? The facts strongly suggest the president directed her to do so. Well, there's a slight problem with the majority counsel's epiphany as it has been passed down to the managers and then to you. For you see, and here is the cell phone record, it reflects that at 3:32 p.m. on December 28th, from Arlington, Virginia to Washington, D.C., that's Ms. Lewinsky's number, there was a call of a minute, it says here. And then we have to ask, does this timing fit with the rest of the testimony? Well, the answer is, no, it doesn't. Because on three separate occasions, Ms. Lewinsky testified that Ms. Curry came over to pick up the gifts at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, an hour and a half before the phone call. Now, it's not as though we've been hiding the ball on this, senators. We discussed this issue at length in our trial brief. And the managers do seem to have recognized at least some of the problem, because they have told you, albeit without the slightest evidentiary support, that maybe Ms. Lewinsky just miscalculated a little bit. Well, maybe she just miscalculated a little bit three times. Look at the record. FBI interview, July 27th. Lewinsky met Curry on 28th Street outside Lewinsky's apartment at about 2 p.m. and gave Curry the box of gifts. FBI interview, August 1st. Lewinsky gave the box to Betty Curry when Curry came by the Watergate about 2 p.m. Grand jury testimony, 3 weeks later. I think it was around 2 p.m. or so, around 2 in the afternoon. Now, the managers speculated that if only the independent counsel had had this phone record when they were interviewing Ms. Lewinsky, they could have refreshed her recollection. Now, having been one, I can tell you that's prosecutor speak for, if we'd only known about that darn record, we could have gotten her to change her testimony. But the managers have one other problem that they didn't address. The phone record, if we can go back to that for a moment. The phone record shows a call lasting 1 minute. And all of us who have cell phones know that that really means it lasted well short of a minute, because the phone company rounds things up to the nearest minute, just to help us all with our bookkeeping. So now it would be necessary not only for Ms. Lewinsky's memory to be refreshed about the hour of the pickup, but to explain how the arrangements for it could have been made between Ms. Lewinsky and Ms. Curry in somewhere between 1 and 60 seconds. Now, putting these factual difficulties aside, this charge must fail for another reason. As you all know from presentations earlier, the president gave Ms. Lewinsky several gifts on the very day that they met, December 28. Now, faced with having to explain why on the day that the president and Monica Lewinsky were conspiring to conceal gifts from the Jones lawyers, the president gave her additional ones, the managers surmised that the real purpose was because it was part of a subtle effort to keep Ms. Lewinsky on the team. But in truth, the only reasonable explanation for these events is the one the president gave to the grand jury. He was simply not concerned about gifts. He gave a lot. He got a lot. And he saw no need to engage in any effort to conceal them. The president did not urge Ms. Lewinsky to conceal the gifts he'd given her, and of course, he did not lie to the grand jury about that subject. The next point I want to discuss with you is the statements that the president made to Betty Curry on the day after his Jones deposition, January 18th of last year. There's no dispute in the record, no conflict in testimony, that the president did meet with his secretary, Betty Curry, on the day after the Jones deposition, and they discussed Monica Lewinsky. The managers cast this conversation, this recitation, this series of statements and questions put by the president to Ms. Curry in the most sinister light possible, and alleged that the president intended to influence the testimony of a witness, quote, witness, unquote, by pressuring Ms. Curry to agree with an inaccurate version of the facts surrounding his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky. The president President Clinton has adamantly denied that he had any such intention, and that denial is fortified by the undisputed factual record establishing that Betty Curry neither was an actual or a contemplated witness in the Jones litigation, nor did she perceive that she was being pressured in any respect by the president to agree with what he was saying. First, Ms. Curry's status as a witness. And the only proceeding that the president knew about at that moment, the Jones case, Ms. Curry was neither an actual nor a prospective witness. As to the only proceeding in which she ultimately became a witness, no one would suggest, managers, no one else would suggest, the president knew that the independent counsel was conducting an investigation into his activities. In the entire history of the Jones case, Ms. Curry's name had not appeared on any of the witness lists, nor was there any reason to suspect Ms. Curry would play any role in the Jones case. Discovery was down to its final days. Now, the managers speculate that the president's own references to Ms. Curry during his deposition meant she was sure to be called by the Jones lawyers. Yet in the days, weeks following the deposition, Jones lawyers never listed her, never contacted her, never added her to any witness list. They never deposed her. They never noticed her deposition. Indeed, when the independent counsel interviewed the Jones lawyers, they apparently neglected to ask whether they'd ever intended to call Betty Curry as a witness. And one can be sure that if such intent existed, they would have asked, and it would have been included in the referral. Moreover, it's a sure bet that the Jones lawyers already knew about Betty Curry and her relationship with Monica Lewinsky. Why? Because we know from her own recorded telephone conversations that Ms. Tripp had been in contact with the Jones lawyers for months. And we know that she spent the evening before the president's deposition telling them everything she knew. It didn't take a few references to his secretary by the president to trigger a subpoena for Betty Curry if they'd ever wanted to do that, and they never did. Nor did the president ever pressure Ms. Curry to alter her recollection. Despite the prosecutor's best efforts to coax Ms. Curry into saying she was pressured to agree with the president, Ms. Curry adamantly denied it. Let me quote just briefly a few lines of her grand jury testimony. Question. Now back again to the four statements that you testified the president made to you that were presented as statements. Did you feel pressured when he told you those statements? Answer. None whatsoever. Question. What was your impression that he wanted you to say because he would end each of the statements with right, with a question? Answer. I do not remember what he wanted me, that he wanted me to say right. He would say right, and I could have said wrong. Question. But he would end each of those questions with a right, and you could either say whether it was true or not true. Answer. Correct. Question. Did you feel any pressure to agree with your boss? Answer. None whatsoever. Now, to understand on a human level why the president reached out for Betty Curry on the day after his deposition, you need only to understand that he had just faced unexpected, detailed questions about his worst nightmare. As he candidly admitted to the grand jury, he had long feared that his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky would ultimately become public. And now, with questioning about her in the Jones case, publication of the first internet article, the day of reckoning had arrived. The president knew that a media storm was about to erupt, and it did. Now, if you're looking for evidence on which to base an inference about the president's intentions with respect to Ms. Curry's testimony, look what he said to her when he knew that she was going before the grand jury. And I remember when I knew she was going to have to testify in the grand jury, and I felt terrible because she'd been through the loss of her sister, this horrible accident at Christmas that killed her brother, and her mother was in the hospital. I was trying to make her understand that I didn't want her to be untruthful to the grand jury, And if her memory was different than mine, it was fine. Just go in there and tell them what she thought. So that's all I remember. The President of the United States did not tamper with a witness. Now next, the managers argue that Mr. Clinton corruptly encouraged Ms. Lewinsky to submit a false affidavit to the Jones lawyers and to lie if she were ever deposed. But the uncontroverted evidence refutes that charge. Indeed, Ms. Lewinsky herself has repeatedly and forcefully denied that anyone ever asked her to lie. There's no way to get around that flat denial, even with the independent counsel's addition of the word explicitly. There was no explicit, implicit, or any other direction to Ms. Lewinsky to lie. Indeed, the only person to whom Ms. Lewinsky said anything inconsistent with her denial was the ubiquitous Ms. Tripp. And as Ms. Lewinsky later told the grand jury, "I think I told her that, you know, at various times the president and Mr. Jordan had told me I have to lie." That wasn't true. Now, left with this record, the managers resort to arguing that Ms. Lewinsky understood that the president wanted her to lie, because he could not have wanted her to file an affidavit detailing their relationship. But the only factual support for this theory cited by the majority is the testimony of Ms. Lewinsky that while the president never encouraged her to lie, he remained silent about what she should have to say or do. And by such silence, she said, "I knew what he meant." The very idea that the president of the United States should face removal from office not because he told Monica Lewinsky to lie or anything of the sort, but because he was silent and Ms. Lewinsky, quote, knew what that meant, unquote, is, I suggest, more than troubling. And so to bolster their flawed "I knew what he meant" theory, the managers assert that the president knew the affidavit would have to be false in order for Ms. Lewinsky to avoid testifying. But the evidence here, too, is that the president repeatedly testified that Ms. Lewinsky could and would file a truthful affidavit. And of course, Ms. Lewinsky herself has made it clear that her definition of the critical terms that might be used in such an affidavit was consistent with the president's. Further testimony from Ms. Lewinsky herself repudiates any suggestion that she was ever encouraged by anyone to lie if she were deposed in the Jones case. In a colloquy with a grand juror, she explicitly and unequivocally rejected the notion that President Clinton encouraged her to deny the relationship after she was learned she was a witness. Referring to discussions about the so-called cover stories that the managers allege were to be used in her testimony, a grand jury asked her, "It is possible that you had these discussions after you learned that you were a witness in the Paula Jones case?" Answer, "I don't believe so, no." Question, "Can you exclude that possibility?" Answer, "I pretty much can." Now, the managers would have you conclude the contrary from a brief snippet of the conversation on December 17th, in which Ms. Lewinsky said that at some point, I don't know if it was before or after the subject of the affidavit came up, the president sort of said, "Well, you know, you can always say you were coming to see Betty or that you were bringing me letters." But Ms. Lewinsky told the FBI when she was interviewed, to the best, this is the FBI talking, to the best of Ms. Lewinsky's memory, she does not believe they discussed in this December 17th conversation the content of any deposition that Ms. Lewinsky might be involved in at a later date. And she told the grand jury the same thing. Describing the very same December 17th conversation, she testified that she and the president did not discuss the idea of her denying their relationship. Ms. Lewinsky, "I really don't remember it. I mean, it would be very surprising for me to be confronted with something that would show me different. But it was 2:30, and the conversation I'm thinking of mainly would have been December 17th, which was," and a juror interjects, "the telephone call." Ms. Lewinsky, "Right. And it was, you know, 2:30 in the morning. I remember the gist of it, and I really don't think so. And it is on that basis that the managers suggest to you that the president obstructed justice. Fourth, Article 2 alleges that the president obstructed justice by denying to his closest aides that he had a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky, the very same denial he made to his family and his friends and the American people. These allegedly impeachable denials took place in the immediate aftermath of the public revelation of the Lewinsky matter, at the very time that the president was denying that relationship to the entire country on national television. Having made the announcement to the whole country, it is simply absurd, I suggest to you, to believe that he was somehow attempting corruptly to influence his senior staff when he told them virtually the same thing at the same time. Now, the managers do not allege, as they could not, that the president attempted to influence the aides' testimony about what they themselves knew concerning his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky. Had they seen her in a particular place? Had they talked to her? Had they talked to the president about it before all of this broke? Indeed, the only evidence these aides had was the very same denial that the entire American people had. Indeed, every member of the grand jury had probably seen this denial by the president on their own television sets. Under the theory proffered by the managers, in essence, every person who heard the president's denial could have been called to the grand jury in order to create still an additional charge of obstruction of justice. The point here was not that the president believed that his staff would be witnesses and that he somehow wanted to influence their testimony. As he explained to the grand jury, what he was trying to do was avoid making them witnesses. But of course, he had to say something to them. He had to say, in the aftermath of January 21st, something to reassure them. And he told them exactly what he told every one of you and everyone in the gallery and everyone who watched television in those days following January 21st. And let me just make this one point. There's absolutely no conflict in the evidence here, despite the manager's somewhat puzzling suggestion that the Senate's deliberations would somehow be aided if two of the senior staff members could be called as witnesses. And not only is there no conflict in the evidence, there's absolutely no basis for the charge that the president was in any way seeking to influence the testimony of his staff before the grand jury. And now we come to the last of the obstruction charges. The managers ask you to find that the President of the United States employed his friend Vernon Jordan to get Monica Lewinsky a job in New York to influence her testimony, or perhaps in a somewhat forlorn effort to escape the reach of the federal rules of civil procedure, actually to hide her from the Jones lawyers in the 8 million people that live in that city. There is, of course, absolutely no evidence to support this conclusion, and so the managers have constructed, out of sealing wax and string and spider's webs, a theory that would lend to a series of otherwise innocuous, indeed exculpatory events, a dark and sinister cast. The undisputed record establishes the following. One, Ms. Lewinsky's New York job search began on her own initiative. Two, the search began long before her involvement in the Jones case. Three, the search had no connection to the Jones case. Four, Vernon Jordan agreed to help her, not at the direction of the president, but at the request of Ms. Curry, Mr. Jordan's longtime friend. And five, the idea to solicit Mr. Jordan's assistant again came not from the president, but from his trip. As I thought about this particular aspect of it, I have to say I was sort of reminded of Iago and Desdemona's handkerchief, but we'll pass on. Both Ms. Lewinsky and Mr. Jordan have repeatedly testified that there was never an agreement, a suggestion, an implication that Ms. Lewinsky would be rewarded with a job for her silence or her false testimony. As Mr. Jordan succinctly put it, quote, unequivocally, indubitable, no. It was only to appease Ms. Tripp that Ms. Lewinsky ultimately told her that she had told Mr. Jordan she wouldn't sign the affidavit until she had a job. But as she told the grand jury, quote, that was definitely a lie, based on something that Linda had made me promise on January 9th. Now, although the managers dismiss as irrelevant Ms. Lewinsky's job search before December, the fact is that Ms. Lewinsky had contemplated looking for a job in New York as early as July 1997, and her interest was strengthened in early October when Ms. Tripp told her that it was unlikely that she'd ever get another job in the White House. And it was then that Ms. Tripp and Ms. Lewinsky discussed the prospect of having Vernon Jordan help her get a job in New York, and Ms. Lewinsky mentioned that idea to the president. Later in October, part of this ongoing search, then UN Ambassador Richardson agreed to interview Ms. Lewinsky at the suggestion of then Deputy Chief of Staff Podesta, who had been asked to help by Ms. Curry. And Ambassador Richardson offered her a job. And she had that job in hand throughout the supposedly critical December timeframe, didn't actually turn it down until early January. And further, in late October, early November, she actually went to her boss at the Pentagon and asked for his help to find a job in New York. But meanwhile, and now we come to what for the managers is the very heart of their case, on November 5th, Ms. Lewinsky had a preliminary meeting with Mr. Jordan, and they discussed a list of potential employers. And all the managers then contend that nothing happened from November 5th, that first meeting, until December 11th, signifying, as they see it, that it must have been Ms. Lewinsky's appearance on the witness list that galvanized Mr. Jordan into action. That's simply false. Ms. Lewinsky had a follow-up telephone conversation with Mr. Jordan around Thanksgiving, in which he told her he was working on the job search and asked her to call him in the first week of December. You'll remember that the president learned that Ms. Lewinsky was on the Jones witness list sometime on December 6th. He met with Mr. Jordan the very next day, December 7th. But oddly, if one adopts the manager's view, there was no discussion of Ms. Lewinsky or the Jones case, much less job searches. And then on December 8th, Ms. Lewinsky called Mr. Jordan's office and made an appointment to meet with him on December 11th. Now, the president had absolutely nothing to do with that call or that appointment, and Mr. Jordan denied that there was any intensified effort to find Ms. Lewinsky a job. He said, oh no, I do not recall any heightened sense of urgency in December. What I do recall is that I dealt with it when I had time to do it. And now for my second example of prosecutorial fudge-making. The managers have devoted much attention to the magic date of December 11th, arguing vigorously that it was on that day that getting a job for Ms. Lewinsky suddenly became a matter of high priority for the president and hence for Mr. Jordan. Why is that so? Well, again, I'll let the majority counsel for the Judiciary Committee tell you in his own words during his closing argument. And again, you should have this before you if you can't see the chart. But why the sudden interest? Why the total change in focus and effort? Nobody but Betty Curry really cared about helping Ms. Lewinsky throughout November, even after the president learned that her name was on the prospective witness list. Did something happen to move the job search from a low to a high priority on that day? Oh yes, something happened. On the morning of December 11th, 1997, Judge Susan Weber Wright ordered that Paula Jones was entitled to information regarding any state or federal employee with whom the president had sexual relations or proposed or sought to have sexual relations. To keep Monica on the team was now of critical importance. Remember, they already knew that she was on the witness list, although nobody bothered to tell her. And that same thing was picked up last week by Mr. Manager Hutchinson, both in his recitation of the events of that day and in the exhibits he showed you. And if I'm lucky, we will put up on the easel to my right the exhibit that Manager Hutchinson used. You'll see the order that this exhibit places for on the critical events of November and December, the November 5th meeting, the November no job search action, President receives the witness list, and then of special interest, December 11th, first event, Judge Wright's order permitting questions about Lewinsky to, on December 11th, the President and Jordan talk about a job for Monica. And now, let me ask you to focus on what Mr. Hutchinson told you about the events of December 11th. Sounding somewhat like Majority Counsel, he asks, and so what triggered? Let's look at the chain of events. The judge, the witness list came in, the judge's order came in, that triggered the President into action, and the President triggered Vernon Jordan into action. And that chain reaction here is what moved the job search along. Remember what else happened on that day, December 11th again? That was the same day that Judge Wright ruled that the questions about other relationships could be asked by the Jones attorneys. Now, it appears to me that the managers are suggesting, again with not a great deal of subtlety, that Vernon Jordan, one of this country's great lawyers and great citizens, was prepared to perjure himself to save the President. So let's just imagine the manager's examination of Mr. Jordan in this chamber that would let you make your own judgment about his truthfulness. Question. Mr. Jordan, isn't it a fact that you met with Ms. Lewinsky on December 11th to help get her a job? Answer. Yes. Question. And isn't it a fact that before and after you met with her, you made calls to potential employers in New York? Yes. And isn't it true that the reason for all this activity on December 11th was that Judge Wright had on that very day issued an order authorizing the Jones lawyers to depose certain women like Ms. Lewinsky? No. Question. What do you mean, no? Isn't it true that the judge had issued her order before you met with Ms. Lewinsky and before you made the calls? Answer. I had no knowledge of any such order. The fact that Ms. Lewinsky was a potential witness had nothing to do with my helping her. I'd made an appointment to see her 3 days earlier. Question. Well, isn't it a fact that Judge Wright filed her order on December 11th before you met with Ms. Lewinsky? Well, actually, no. Let me show you the official report of the judge's discussion with the lawyers in the Jones case on that date. And you have this before you as well. The conference call between the judge and the lawyers, which is memorialized in a formal document prepared by her clerk and on file in the case in Arkansas, notes that the conference call began at 5:33 p.m. Central Standard Time. If I have my calculations right, that's 6:33 p.m. in Washington. Now, I want to stop here for just a second so you know where Mr. Jordan was when that happened. Can we see the next chart? By the way, this is Mr. Jordan testifying again. I was actually on a plane for Amsterdam by the time the judge issued her order. So he testified in the grand jury. I left on United Flight 946 at 5:55 from Dulles Airport and landed at Amsterdam the next morning. Can we go back, Mike, to the previous one? So the conference call begins at 6:33 Eastern Standard Time. And the court takes up another variety of matters, and the judge didn't even tell the lawyers that she was going to issue an order on their motion to compel these various depositions until the very end of the call, around 7:45 Eastern Standard Time, and that the clerk would actually fax them a copy at that point. And so, to return to Mr. Jordan's mythical testimony. And so, to summarize, let me show you something that tells you what the real sequence of events was on December 11th. Vernon Jordan makes a possible job call at 9:45, another at 12:49, another at 1:07. He meets with Ms. Lewinsky from 1:15 to 1:45. He gets on his plane at 5:55 in the afternoon, and an hour or so later, the lawyers are informed that the judge had issued her order. In fact, just as a little fillip, the president's out of town and returns to Washington on 1:10, 1:10 a.m., and actually, Judge Wright's order is filed not on the 11th, but on the 12th. Question. Oh, I see. Well, never mind. Now, does any of you think, that you need to look Mr. Jordan in the eye and hear his tone of voice to understand that the prosecutors have got it wrong and have had, at least since the majority counsel's closing argument? Now, you will also learn from us, but not from the managers, that Mr. Jordan placed no pressure on any company to give Ms. Lewinsky a job. Indeed, two of the companies he called didn't even offer her a job. And just as the managers dramatically misstate the record relating to Mr. Jordan's efforts to help Ms. Lewinsky find a job, so too do they invent a non-existent link between a call Mr. Jordan made ultimately to Mr. Perlman, the CEO of McAndrews and Forbes, Revlon's parent, and the offer Ms. Lewinsky finally received from Revlon with her signing of the affidavit in the Jones case. We will demonstrate, beyond any question, once again, the conclusions the managers have drawn are simply false. Begin with the fact that both Mr. Jordan and Ms. Lewinsky have testified that there was no such link between the job and the affidavit. And the only person to ever suggest such a link was, once again, Ms. Tripp. Now, I presume that it is not the manager's intention to suggest that we bring Ms. Tripp before you to explore her motivations for making that suggestion. Next, take Ms. Lewinsky's interview with the McAndrews official, which she described as having gone poorly, a characterization adopted by the managers for obvious reasons, because it suggests that there was a desire on their part to heighten the supposed relevance of the call that Mr. Jordan made to Mr. Perlman. In other words, under their theory, Ms. Lewinsky's job prospects at McAndrews and Forbes, or at Revlon, were kaput until Vernon Jordan made the call and resurrected her chances. Unfortunately, like so much of the obstruction case, the facts do not bear this convenient theory. In fact, the man who interviewed Ms. Lewinsky at McAndrews was impressed with her, and because there was nothing available in his area, sent her resume to Revlon, where she was hired by someone who did not know about Mr. Jordan's call to Mr. Perlman. So much for obstruction by job search. That, then, is an overview of the charges contained in these articles. You'll hear about them in greater detail than I could offer you today, and my colleagues speak in the next 2 days. But I want to bring my presentation to you to a close . We are not here to defend William Clinton, the man. He, like all of us, will find his judges elsewhere. We are here to defend William Clinton, the President of the United States, for whom you are the only judges. You are free to criticize him, to find his personal conduct distasteful, but ask whether this is the moment when, for the first time in our history, the actions of a president have so put at risk the government the framers created that there is only one solution. You must find not merely that removal is an acceptable option, that we will be okay the day after you vote. You must find that it's the only solution, that our democracy should not be made to sustain 2 more years of this president's service. You must put that question, because the one thing that our form of government cannot abide is the notion that impeachment is merely one more weapon the Congress can use in the contest between the legislative and executive branches. Let me be very clear. We do not believe that President Clinton committed any of the offenses charged by the managers. And for the reasons we'll set out at length over the next 2 days, we believe the managers have misstated the record, have constructed their case out of tenuous extrapolations without foundation, have at every turn assumed the worst without the evidence to support their speculations. You put these lawyers in a courtroom and they win 10 times out of 10. But suppose we're wrong. Suppose that you find that the president committed one or more of the offenses that the managers have charged. Then there remains only one issue before you. Whatever your feelings may be about William Clinton, the man, or William Clinton, the political ally or opponent, or William Clinton, the father and the husband, ask only this: should William Clinton, the president, be removed from office? Are we at that horrific moment in our history when our union can be preserved only by taking the step that the framers saw as a last resort? Now, I'm never certain how to respond when an advocate on the other side of the case calls up images of patriots over the centuries who have sacrificed themselves to preserve our democracy. I have no personal experience with war. I've only visited Normandy as a tourist. But I do know this. My father was on Omaha Beach 55 years ago. And I know how he would feel if he were today. He didn't fight, no one fought for one side of this case or the other. He fought as all those did, for our country, our Constitution. And as long as each of us, manager, president's counsel, senator, does his or her constitutional duty, those who fought for their country will be proud. We, the people of the United States, have formed a more perfect union. We've formed it. We nurtured it. We've seen it grow. We have not been perfect. And it is perhaps the most extraordinary thing about our Constitution that it thrives despite our human imperfections. When the American people hear the president talk to Congress tonight, They will know the answer to the question, neighbor, how stands the Union? It stands strong, vibrant, free. And I close as I opened 2 hours ago, 2.5 hours ago. William Jefferson Clinton is not guilty of the charges that have been brought against him. He didn't commit perjury. He didn't obstruct justice. He must not be removed from office. Thank you.
The chair recognizes the majority leader.
Mr. Chief Justice, in a moment, the Senate will recess until 8:35 p.m. this evening, at which time the Senate will proceed as a body over to the House of Representatives for a joint session to receive a message from the President. Following the joint session, the Senate will adjourn until 11 a.m. tomorrow morning. As a reminder to all senators, the Leaders Lecture Series is scheduled for tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. in the old Senate chamber with former President George Bush as the guest speaker. I now ask the Senate stand in recess under the previous order.
In the absence of objection, it's so ordered.